ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Marcel Karp, a writer, producer, and feminist, probably best known as the co-founder of Bust, one of the flagship publications of third-wave feminism. More recently, Marcel has launched Barb Magazine, a lifestyle site for women over 40. She's also produced the monthly stand-up show at Upright Citizens Brigade, We Hope You Have Fun, which is hosted by her teenage daughter, author Ruby Karp. Marcel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So you launched Bust back in 1993, and it was a print magazine, right?
Yeah, I launched it with another like-minded feminist. And in 1993, there was a World Wide Web, but it wasn't as we know it today. The language of digital and even branding wasn't as ubiquitous as it is at this very moment. So we launched it as a zine, which, again, in that era, what meant that it was a DIY, do-it-yourself magazine. And in our day, or at that time, what that really meant was you just created a magazine or a version of a magazine on your own to your specifications. So there were zines that were, you know, the size of your passport to the size of the New York Times print version laid out. Like, you can make it as large or as small, as thick, as wide as you wanted. It was DIY. It was do it yourself, whatever you wanted to do. And we created Bust. Our first issue was in July 1993 as a zine. It was Xerox and stapled, front back. Xerox in those days, I guess photocopy now, front and back. Front and back, about 32, 36 pages. Yeah.
Wow. So, but now you're launching a new publication of sorts, and obviously the world is a really different place. And now that you've been through sort of Barb Magazine lifestyle site, the launch sort of, you're through first, past the first blushes of launch, comparing the two things, what would you say are the biggest differences?
That's such a great question. I don't get asked that very often. You know, with Barb, in this first year of Barb, which I launched in the wake of the 2016 election, what I really wanted to focus on to the point of perfection almost was creating the voice and figuring out, like, who I was in the digital space, how I spoke to people, what I revealed, the kind of things I wanted people to hone in on and talk about. And so with Barb as a digital project, it's really, in this first year, it's establishing a foundation for myself as a founder, as a creator, as a visionary. With Bust, what was very different was that it was a different platform. It was print, and so the reach was very limited. Our first issue that we photocopied, we had 1,000 copies that we printed initially and mailed out, and then over time we would, you know, go back to the machine and reprint it as we needed, recopy it as we needed to, or if people asked for it. Even now, I can just go to the local Staples and just make another photocopy of my first issue of Bust. But again, what the difference was that the reach was very different. Now I know with Barb, I can reach somebody in a part of this world that I would never have imagined existed, or she would exist, or that she would find me. But she can find me because she has access to a keyboard and a World Wide Web and an infinite reach. So that's like one of the major differences between the two. The parallels are are just, you know, they're endless. It's, you know, the voice, the person behind it, the experience, you know, as a woman in my 20s, what I was experiencing was so important to me at that moment. As a woman in my 50s, what's important is what I'm experiencing is so important to me. You know, so there's there's a lot of these, like, very self-interest agenda-y kind of parallels.
Well, I guess a couple of things. One of the things that has come up in my conversations with people is the ease with broad touch, if you will, like that woman who knows where as long as she has a keyboard, and yet really connecting, sort of moving it beyond almost like hashtag activism and true engagement is challenging. Whereas that person who got that Xeroxed copy was sought it out in a very active way. And I wonder if you feel a difference in terms of once you've got them difference, if that's at all different. Is it sort of easier to launch but harder to get attention? Or is it not easier to launch in this new day and age? It's just as hard, it's only different.
It's just as difficult. You know, the woman that, or the girl with, you know, multiple R's that we were speaking to in the 90s, she was everywhere. We just didn't know where. You know, we knew she was in Olympia. We knew she was in the East Village. We knew she was in Austin. But we didn't know that she was, like, somewhere in Kentucky. We didn't know that she was in Tampa. Like, we didn't know. You know, we hoped, but we didn't really know. And that was an incredible challenge. And I was in charge of distribution in those days. And in 1993, my distribution source was a little pamphlet that Fact Sheet 5, which was a zine resource, put out that I bought at a zine store. See Here on East 7th Street, which is not there anymore. And I went, and this little publisher's guide told you, like, you know, who to contact, where to contact them. You know, there was like a dozens of mom and pop record stores, bookstores that were supportive of zines. But, you know, I couldn't touch my keyboard and find like 55 record stores across the country. No, like I had that one little pamphlet. Of course, at the time, Tower Records was a chain. So if you got the head of distribution to pick up your zine, he or she would order, you know, like 50 copies of Bust and then send them to the markets that they thought it would do well in. So, you know, you had people thinking along the lines of markets and this kind of thing. But I didn't know that. I only know that in hindsight. No. I figured it out along the way. I mean, at that time, I mean, I had so much hubris, and I'm so happy I did. I sent Bust to everybody in the Fact Sheet 5 book pamphlet. I sent it to everybody. I sent it to Tower Records. I sent it to the mom and pop stores. I sent it to, you know, like, hardcore punk rock store. Like, I sent it everywhere. And then I would, diligently call and follow up every single store I sent it to or person and be like, will you carry our Bust? And, you know, would you? And, blah, blah, blah. And that's how I got distribution, because I was tenacious. I was like in, you know, in our mom's time, an Avon lady, you know, like I was like door to door salesperson.
But is that an advantage? I mean, was that an advantage because you were willing to put in the work? You couldn't just sort of like recline and do a Google search. I mean, that was a differentiator. You know, have the tools made it harder to get attention because everybody's got them and the lazy person is easy to confuse with the hardworking person?
Well, it was hard. It wasn't hard to get attention of the women the women like us. You know, the girls like us, because we knew that we found Riot Girl. We knew that we cared about and we believed Anita Hill. We knew that we were at that rally. We knew that we would find other girls like us. We knew that. We just didn't know how. Now I can go to my keyboard and type in, you know, Barb magazine, and I will see myself reflected there. I can type in newyorkmag.com and go to the culture, and I can see stuff that I'm interested in there. The access I have now is very different than what I had in 1993. The reach I have now is on par with what I had in 1993, except my reach now is global. And, you know, it's through my social media, it's through my friends who tell their friends, it's through the people who, you know, click on something and then re-share it on their various channels. So it's obvious that it's different. It's just, it's the challenge is how hard am I willing to fight for those eyeballs? I'm willing to fight the way I did in 1993. I want women over 40 to know that there's an alternative for them, that they're not necessarily and only relegated to the glossy, the, you know, the Vogues and the kind of generic women's markets, that there's a market of women who read Generation X, who are now women in their 50s, who are now, you know, who were at the Bikini Kill shows and went to See Hole and, you know, worshipped at the Shrine of Pavement. We're all growing at the same rate. We're all getting older at the same time. We just have different interests now. Some of us have had children. Some of us have lost parents. Some of us have pets. You know, we've made a lot of life choices, but now we're embedded in them. You know, if you're over 40, you're thinking about retirement plans. If you're over 50, you know you only have like 15 years left before the big R enters your life. You know, if you're over 60, you know you just have a few more years left, and then you get to live off whatever pension or social security. You know, so the math starts to change a lot after 40, and it changes exponentially as you hit another milestone. Whereas in your 20s, whole world's in front of you.
Well, I mean, that's actually one of the things I wanted to ask you about. Is you did add this dimension of age. And it really comes into play. And I think one of the things that's interesting is the challenge of when you are in your 20s, age, people generally are in the same spot in life, but it quickly diverges. And so you're right that a woman of 40 may or may not have children, may or may not have gotten married, may or may not have living parents. And so those choices make for different interests, which has made it challenging for like Mirabella magazine, which was targeting a slightly older population. And I don't think it couldn't survive. It was print. Obviously, all print has suffered. Do you think that ageism and feminism are intertwined in a way that is distinct and different than the ageism that men experience?
Absolutely. And what's even like taking a step back from comparing the experience of genders, ageism is rampant as you get younger, you know, like, so when I was 25, if you put Germaine Greer's The Change in front of me, her, you know, pioneering book on her experience with menopause, I would have laughed at you. I would have been like, freaking kidding me? No, I'm not interested. I'm interested in getting laid, trying to figure out like what band I'm going to go see and like what time I need to wake up in the morning. My interests were so completely revolved around me. I didn't care what older men and women had to say to me about anything. And I was in my 20s in the 80s and 90s. When I hit my 30s, and certainly once I launched Bust, the idea of second wave, not the idea, the reality of second wave and what they did for the third wave feminists, like the work that they laid down became something that I revered and respected and idealized to an incredible extent. And I felt ashamed of like my 20 something year old feminist behavior. So yeah, no, I think ageism, the bias against being older is constant throughout the course of your life. Oh, you know, let's not go talk to that manager. She's too old. She won't get it. Now that I'm in my 50s and I'm like, wait, I'm not dead yet. And I have so much more to offer and so much more to say. I'm indignant about it. Like I publish Barb Monday through Friday. That's what I've learned how to do, that like I only want to work 5 days a week on my blog. There's not a day that goes by where I don't see an article on ageism that I think could be relevant to my readers. I don't always put a link to it, but, you know, so many women I know are experiencing such bias and such discrimination because she has like one too many lines on her forehead. It's not just ladies in their 50s, it's ladies in their 40s. Like, we're, you know, I'll be up for a job. I've been up for so many jobs in the last year where it's gone to my male counterpart. Not because he was better than me, because I know, like most women, we know we're the smartest people in the room and we're the best at our, the one thing that we do. I knew that every person that beat me out, I could have done a much better job. Like, you know, somebody that was hired was indecisive. Another person that was hired didn't have as much broad experience. Another, you know, this kind of thing. And I could like one up each person to the man.
How much would you say you think was, how much of that was gender though, and how much of that was ageism, or was it a blend of the two? And is it that it's okay to have a man in his mid-50s, whereas a woman, holy smokes, we don't want her in that bracket. Although, you know, a woman isn't going to get, once they're past childbearing, I mean, you'd think that's sort of like a second lease on life. Women, you know, really come into their own, or so I've read.
I think like in my experience, it's been a blend. You know, I was up for a job at some organization where the person who was hiring me was a 30-year-old woman. This was the only job she'd ever had. I wasn't going to be reporting to her, but we would be counterparts. And she completely, within 12 seconds of me walking into the room, I saw what happened to her face. You know, I saw what she saw. She saw her mom. And again, like, I don't look like everybody's mom. Sometimes my hair is pink. Sometimes I wear motorcycle boots. Sometimes I wear jeans. Like, sometimes I wear a really fine dress that's form-fitting. I don't look like your typical mom, but when you're 30 and you see a 50-year-old woman walk in, all you see is, like, you know, like in that Charlie Brown cartoon when the peanuts, when the teacher would be speaking and Charlie Brown would just hear, wah. That's what this woman saw. She just saw the white noise of an older woman, probably her mom, walking, coming at her. And then, and later when I followed up, they hired a man who was in his 30s.
So it was a double, it was a twofer.
Yeah. I have a really great reputation in my industry. I've done a lot of things. I know that I'm better than most people at what I do specifically, but I've been part of a generation that's built an industry, and I've been slowly being pushed out. And it's right. Incredible to see it. And also, like, in the year that I've been writing and blogging on Barb, you know, I've been very honest about what I've been confronting, and that's what, where the power in Barb comes to the fore. You know, the honesty that I bring to that table or to that screen is what women are connecting with. Like, the women who write to me, who message me on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook, like, you know, oh my God, this is happening to me. Oh my God, what do you think I should do? Like, the amount of connection I'm getting, especially now that I've been doing it for a year, and, you know, I'm getting a few hundred views a day and this kind of thing. Like, I'm connecting to an audience that's, again, has been ignored. Or is not, she's not being heard, or she's not seeing herself somewhere. Like, I'm connecting to an audience because I know that there are women like me out there. So, so I like that, and I'm responding to it. And so as I go into my second year of blogging, now becomes the challenge of what I did with Bust in 1993, which is ROI. You know, like thinking about it from a financial perspective, like thinking about advertising and thinking about partnerships and thinking about growth in a much bigger way, which is what we did with Bus. You know, like in, with Bus, it was like we photocopied 1,000 copies. And then, you know, in our fourth issue, there was a woman named Lucy Gwynn who did a zine for people who were wheelchair bound. And she said to me, oh my God, she got a copy of Bus. She was like, I think she lived in Ithaca. And she said, you need to put a subscription page on the first inside page of your magazine. And I was like, why? And she was like, because you'll get $10 right up front. And then that $10 can pay, if you get, you know, if you get 200 checks for $10, that can pay for the publication of your next issue. And it was like, when she said that to me in 1994, it was like a light bulb went on in my brain, like, oh, we can monetize this? We can monetize like our take on feminism, and we we had just realized that we were part of a third wave. I think 1994 is when third wave started becoming part of our vernacular. Maybe it was 93, I'm not sure. But I'm having that same eureka moment now. Like, there's a way to monetize doing what you love if what you've done for your career is not fulfilling that for you anymore. If I can't pay my bills doing the thing that I have loved more than anything else other than being a feminist and, of course, raising my daughter, then I can go back to, like, the thing that I really know I was destined to do, which is to continue to support women on a much larger scale.
Well, it seems like, you know, we're seeing a lot of interest. The zeitgeist in culture is working a lot of interest in raising women's voices. The Golden Globes a few weeks back was really different than anything we've ever seen before. And yet simultaneously, we're seeing sort of a hyper-sexualized social environment. And, you know, especially on some of the social platforms, some of the young influencers, the young women. And what do you make of that? And do you think that as they age, they'll age out of influence? Or are we going to start seeing influencers of an older age? Will brands recognize that people have influence and have money as they get older?
It's my hope that brands will realize that the people who have money are not the shiny ones. It's the people who are over 40 who have been working their asses off to build their careers and who are at the top of their game. Those are the people with money, the housewives in the suburbs. They're the people who are making the decisions on how to spend money. That's where brands need to focus. Now, I worked in an industry that was very youth-oriented, that only cared about the 25-year-old male who was shooting pool in a bar somewhere. That was the target for every advertiser. And, you know, you'd sit there and just be like, these guys have no money. They can barely buy beer. They're not buying beer for their girlfriends. Like, why do you think they're going to buy your car? But that falls on deaf ears. I did kind of shop Barb around for a minute before I launched it as a digital platform. And, you know, the reactions I got from some companies were like, nobody cares about women over 40. And, you know, that's a real honest answer. It's not the answer I want to hear, but it's pretty honest. And as I do Barb, and as I'm involved with other brands that care about women over 40, other sites who are launching and podcasts like yours, you know, you'll start to see a wave of interest because every generation ages. So, like, you know, I look at the influencers who are in their 20s. Yeah, I was that beautiful and that shiny too. And people listened to me when I was your age. And then I got knocked up. I had a baby. Things changed. You know, you do grow out of showing your ass. You do grow out of advertising your wares. You know, you grow out of these things because other things take over, like you said earlier. Like, your interest as you age shifts a great deal, especially if you've had children or have pets, or, you know, you've helped your parents die. Like, your interest changes as you get older.
Right. Well, it's interesting. I had a conversation with a woman who has designed a platform for millennials by millennials. And one of the things I asked her was, so are you going to age your platform with your peers, or are you going to continue focusing on your youth, or are you just going to simply expand? Because, like it or not, aging happens. And so that was an interesting conversation to have. I'm curious, have you experienced interest from brands in what you're doing? And also, given that you do have a deep marketing and promotion experience, how have you brought that into what you're doing? And I'm sure that is a differentiator among the other people sort of in the environment.
So to answer your second question, the way I've sort of laid it out was like, here's your 5-year plan. You know, spend your first year working on your voice. I'm not looking for a shortcut to financial success. I'm thinking about this in the long term. It is a long game. It is a 5-year plan. It is something that requires a 360 perspective at all times. And so I have to take it, because I'm just sort of functioning by myself, I have like a stable of writers, and I have, you know, a really nice array of loyal return customers, as it were. I'm not trying to do anything too quickly. I'm gonna grow in it at my own pace within the scope of what I've set myself out, like the like the plan I've set out for myself. And I feel really comfortable with that. I don't have a board that I have to answer to. I don't have stocks that I need to watch. Like, it's just me. And so the plan I've laid out for myself is comfortable. It utilizes my knowledge as a creative, as a marketer, as a digital person, and as a storyteller. It uses all of these tools. And I'm not taxing myself. I'm challenging myself, but I'm not burning the candle on both ends. And I'm really comfortable with that.
Well, also, I'm curious, conversely, having launched your site and made this foray and really learning some of these lessons, firsthand, what are some things that you think that your peers or these, youngsters who are sitting in networks desperately need to learn that they don't maybe know? What could they learn from your experience?
I think what anybody who's building a business that is going to become something that's ubiquitous with the word brand has to really consider and take the time to build the story of the brand. And you'll see a lot of sites pop up where they're just throwing a lot of spaghetti against the wall. We're going to cover music and Kardashian and this and that and this and that. And you don't know what they're really going for. Or they'll put like a buzzy kind of word like wellness, and then you'll go to it and it'll be like five things I learned about Doctor Who. It has nothing to do with wellness. You have to identify who you are and who your brand is, which is who you are. That's the biggest mistake I see across the board when I see sites that are just kind of just doing way too much. And if they did that, their brand could resonate in such huge and wonderful ways. And I'm not, that's probably the biggest mistake. And then, everything else after that, trying to grow too quickly, trying to chase numbers. Chasing numbers is, the second biggest mistake every brand makes. It's like you're chasing something, you're not going to be able to build anything. You have to build it and not chase it.
Uh-huh. Well, and would you say that that's something that doesn't just apply to the small new startup, but actually applies to large companies that have been around for a while even? I mean, you look at some networks and you wonder, do they know who they are anymore?
No, yeah, exactly. I mean, we could look at, and I have a lot of friends who work inside these networks, and every so often I send an email saying, that's not on your brand, right? Like, you're way off brand. And the answer will always be like, this is what my boss is having me do. They are so chasing the approval of a board that they're not staying faithful to their brand.
Right. Well, and so their brand then ceases to exist, which is interesting. Would you say that your site at this point then is a business or a statement or a bit of both?
It's a combination of both. It's still a statement. It's still a rally cry. It was so funny. About 6 months ago, I had a conversation with somebody who was working on a site, and he said, and it was a man, and he said to me, I don't think your audience cares about activism. I think they want to hear you talk more about sex. And I said, why? I said, why? Why do you think women in their 50s who have children or who have, who particularly the ones who have children, why do you think they want to hear me talk about sex and not about that the march is coming up? Why? And he's like, well, you're sexy. And what you're known for is being like this sexy goddess. And I just was like, it's all you can do in those moments where you don't lunge across the room and punch them in the box. Like, you're just like, are you, what? So, for me, it's like a woman over 40 has a lot to think about. She has to think, she's thinking about her sex life or her relationship with sex or even her sexuality, but she's also thinking about other kinds of pictures, whether she wants to be at the march. Does she care about the march? Is the march important to her? Does she want to know who Kamala Harris is and Kate Brown, or you know, does she care about Michelle Obama? Like, what does she care about? I don't know. I certainly have an interest in it. If I have an interest in it, then there's somebody else who might have an interest. That's what I come back to, like, over and over again. If I have an interest in it, then certainly someone else will.
Right, right. One of the things I'm curious about also, just because you describe it as a lifestyle site, how do you avoid the risks of becoming a punchline like Goop?
Well, you know, Goop, you know,
yes.
I know. It's like one of the curses of partnering with the celebrity is that the celebrity has to have a certain amount of credibility. So like I look at something like Smart Girls at the Party, which Amy Poehler started. Amy Poehler has a lot of credibility. You don't look at her and go, no, you look at her and you go, what else do you have to say? And that she's launched a site for young girls. 10 years ago, my daughter was 7 when she went on Smart Girls at the Party and talked about feminism. My daughter's now 17 and has written her own book. Like, Amy Poehler honed in on the absolute potential of young girls, girls who were my daughter's age at the time and girls who were teenagers. And she made a beautiful and inspiring business out of it. That's something. You take someone like Gwyneth Paltrow, who is a little bit more controversial. She's an Oscar-winning actress who at some point in her life made it clear that she was more spiritual and that she had an interest in wellness, and she turned that into a business, and people just like laughed at it. And you could come up with a million reasons why they laughed at it, but they don't, it's not a site that gets taken seriously, and then every so often they don't do their research and they get caught in a trap. So like when I was launching Barb, a part of me wanted to partner with a celebrity because I knew that a celebrity would attract a huge amount of attention and a huge amount of press. But the question was, what celebrity over 40 that hasn't really established her own brand would I want to partner with that would be someone that I could be proud to be partnered with? And
right.
I have a short list, which I could always tell you offline, but it ended up being for me more interesting to just pursue it on my own.
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. Absolutely. We have run through our time already.
Oh, no.
It's gone really, really quickly. I know. But one of the things I like to do, and I think it'll be interesting to get your take on this, is do a little thing where I fire off some words and you just give me your top of mind response. Just the first word that comes to your head, don't think too much about it. Ready?
Yep, I'm ready.
Facebook.
Aw, that's my response.
Okay. Google.
And you know why? Because Facebook is just a pile of nostalgia for me, and I just love it. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good. Google.
Yeah. Google information.
Snapchat.
Porn portal. Porn portal.
Twitter.
Yeah. Twitter, a joke machine.
YouTube.
Eye candy.
Ad blockers. Art.
My heart bursting with joy.
VR.
VR, the next wave.
AR.
I have no idea.
AI.
You know, this is not a one-word answer, but I cannot get with AI ever since I saw the AI movie, and then that poor AI was left alone in the forest screaming for his mommy, but didn't know it wasn't really his real mommy. I can't. So that's my relationship with AI. It makes me emotional.
It makes you emotional. That's really interesting. You know, in Japan, they remember that dog, the Sony dog, the robot dog thing. Apparently in Japan, people became so attached that there was a cottage industry creating funerals for these dogs, these machines. So people end up having these emotional, it's sort of like she or something, you know. Anyway, last question is, what excites you most on the horizon?
Oh, professionally would be...
Anything. Yeah. What is it?
What excites me most on the horizon is comedy, is watching the next wave of stand-up comics like come up and seeing, you know, what their take on the world is, what's going to happen with Barb, And of course, my daughter going to college in the fall.
Excellent. Well, again, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for inviting me to be on your podcast, Gabrielle. I really appreciate it.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who have helped bring the program to life. First, my friend, Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open. And of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media, and a big thank you to our guest, Marcel Karp. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.